times in American history. At Leventa's height, Olmec art and technical innovations could be found throughout Mesoamerica. So widespread was Olmec iconography, jaguar babies, carved stelae, distinctly shaped ceramics, that many archaeologists believed its very ubiquity was evidence that the Olmec not only engendered Mesoamerica, but also brought forth the first Mesoamerican empire. The description is from Ignacio Bernal, once director of Mexico's famed National Museum of Anthropology. Bernal, who died in 1992, envisioned an imperium that spanned much of southern Mexico, proselytizing its religion and forcing other groups to send their finest works to its heartland. The Olmec, he thought, were the Romans of Mesoamerica, a magisterial society that established the pattern which, through the centuries, was to be followed by other expansionist Mesoamerican cultures. Since Bernal's death, many researchers have come to view the Olmec differently. According to the University of Michigan anthropologists Kent Flannery and Joyce Marcus, the Olmec heartland was but one of four regional power centers. The central basin to the north, where settlements like Tlatelolco and Tlapacoya laid the groundwork for the empires of Teotihuacan and the Toltecs. In the isthmus, the chiefdoms of Oaxaca, the Olmec along the Gulf Coast, and later the Maya polities in Yucatan and northern Guatemala. Some believe that there was a fifth power, Chalcatzingo, an important chiefdom between the central basin and Oaxaca. In the first millennium BC, all four, or five, were making the transition from individual fortified villages to groups of chiefdoms to states with centralized authority. Although the Olmec preceded the others, they did not set the template for them. Instead, they all influenced each other, sometimes by trade, sometimes by violence, each one developing new techniques, exporting unique goods, and swiping ideas from the others. In this world of competitive interaction, all parties hustled for advantage. Trade in goods was important, but it was the trade in ideas that mattered. By making this argument, I'm endorsing one side in the long-running dispute between mother and sister culture proponents. In other words, as one mother culture advocate put it, I am swallowing Marcus's nonsense whole. He may be right, but I would argue that there is a difference between inheriting a cultural tradition, as the Norte Chico culture's successors apparently did, and copying one, as the Olmec's proponents argue. Nobody disputes that Han Chinese society arose long before its neighbors in Asia. But Asian archaeologists don't refer to China as Asia's mother culture, because China's neighbors used part of its intellectual legacy to build up their own distinct and different writing systems, agricultural technologies, imperial practices, and much else. Given the evidence available now, the same seems to be true for the Olmec and ancient Mesoamerica. To me, anyway, many researchers disagree. Emblematic of this rocketing growth were the Olmec's neighbors in Oaxaca. The Zapotec, whom Flannery and Marcus have studied for more than two decades. The Zapotec were based across the mountains from the Olmec, in Oaxaca's high central valley. Three 40 to 60 mile long bowls that intersect in a ragged Y. By about 1550 BC, they were abandoning the life of hunting and gathering to live in villages with defensive palisades. Here, as elsewhere in this book, I am being chronologically inexact. The oldest Zapotec palisade Flannery and Marcus excavated yielded calibrated radiocarbon dates in the range between 1680 and 1410 BC, which, for brevity's sake, I render as about 1550 BC. These early villages had wattle and daub houses, fine pottery, and some public architecture. They were controlled by big men, the social scientist's term for the alpha male, who is able in such informal settings to enforce his will through persuasion or force. Within a few hundred years, the big men acquired rank. That is, They began to wield power not only because of their personal charisma, but also because their societies had given them an elevated official position. It is the difference between the leading spirit on a pickup basketball team and the officially selected captain of a college squad. After this, political consolidation proceeded apace. Soon the valley was dominated by three main chiefdoms, one at each endpoint of the Y. They did not get along. A 30-square-mile buffer zone in the middle, Flannery and Marcus noted, was virtually unoccupied. The biggest of the three chiefdoms was located near today's village of San Jose Magote. Around 750 BC, it was attacked and its temple razed in a fire so intense that the clay walls melted. San Jose Magote quickly rebuilt the temple a few yards away. Across the new threshold, artisans laid a carved stone. Splayed across its face, suitable for stomping on, was a bas-relief of a naked, disemboweled male corpse, apparently a defeated enemy, blood welling from his side. The carving, to my taste, is beautifully done, as graphically elegant, despite the gory subject matter, as a Matisse. What matters most to researchers, though, is not the design, but the two curious marks between the cadaver's feet. The two marks are glyphs, the oldest firmly dated writing in the Americas. Despite their brevity, they are full of information, both because of the nature of written language and because of the special way Mesoamerican people chose their names. Counting and writing. Writing begins with counting. When a culture grows big enough, it acquires an elite, which needs to monitor things it considers important. Money, stored goods, births and deaths. The progression of time. In the Fertile Crescent, village accountants began keeping records with clay tokens around 8000 BC. As the need for precision grew, they scratched marks on the tokens as mnemonic devices. For example, they might have distinguished a count of sheep from one of wheat by drawing a sheep on one and a wheat stalk on the other. Gradually, the information on each record increased. The bureaucrats were not intending to create writing. Instead, they were simply adding useful features as they became necessary. By 3200 BC, Sumerian scribes had progressed to inscribing on clay tablets with sharpened reeds. A tablet might contain, say, two hash marks, a box, a circle with a cross in the middle, an asterisk-like shape, and an arrangement of three triangles. Scribes would know that the hash marks meant two. The box was a temple, the circle stood for cattle, an asterisk meant goddess, and the triangles were Inanna, two cattle owned by the goddess Inanna's temple. Here I am lifting an example from Gary Urton, a Harvard anthropologist. They had no way to indicate verbs or adjectives, no way to distinguish subject from object, and only a limited vocabulary. Nonetheless, Sumerians were moving toward something like writing. In Mesoamerica, timekeeping provided the stimulus that accounting gave to the Middle East. Like contemporary astrologers, the Olmec, Maya, and Zapotec believe that celestial phenomena like the phases of the moon and Venus affect daily life. To measure and predict these portents requires careful sky watching and a calendar. Strikingly, Mesoamerican societies developed three calendars. A 365-day secular calendar, like the contemporary calendar. A 260-day sacred calendar that was like no other calendar on Earth. And the equally unique long count. A one-by-one tally of the days since a fixed starting point thousands of years ago. Establishing these three calendars required advances in astronomy. Synchronizing them required ventures into mathematics. The 260-day ritual calendar may have been linked to the orbit of Venus. The 365-day calendar, of course, tracked the Earth's orbit around the Sun. Dates were typically given in both notations. For example, October 12, 2004, is 2, Lemat, 11, Yaks, where 2 Lemet is the date in the ritual calendar, and 11 Yaks, the date in the secular calendar. Because the two calendars do not have the same number of days, they are not synchronized. The next time 2 Lemet occurs in the sacred calendar, it will be paired with a different day in the secular calendar. After October 12, 2004, in fact, 2 Lemet and 11 Yaks will not coincide again for another 18,980 days, about 52 years. Mesoamerican cultures understood all this and realized that by citing dates with both calendars, they were able to identify every day in this 52-year period uniquely. What they couldn't do was distinguish one 52-year period from another. It was as if the Christian calendar referred to the year only as, say, 04. One would then be unable to distinguish between 1904, 2004, and 2104. To prevent confusion, Mesoamerican societies created the third calendar, the long count. The long count tracks time from a starting point, much as the Christian calendar begins with the purported birth date of Christ. The starting point is generally calculated to have been August 11, 3114 BC, though some archaeologists put the proper date at August 10th, or 13th, or even September 6th. Either way, long count dates consisted of the number of days, 20-day months, 360-day years, 7,200-day decades, and 144,000-day millennia since the starting point. Archaeologists generally render these as a series of five numbers separated by dots, in the manner of Internet protocol addresses. Using the August 11th starting date, October 12th, 2011, would be written in the long count as 12.19.18.14.4. Because it runs directly from 1 BC to 1 AD, the Christian calendar was long a headache for astronomers. Scientists tracking supernovae, cometary orbits, and other celestial phenomena would still have to add or subtract a year manually when they crossed the AD-BC barrier. If a 16th century astronomer named Joseph Scaliger hadn't got sick of the whole business and devised a calendar for astronomers that doesn't skip a year. The Julian calendar, which Scaliger named after his father, counts the days since day zero. Scaliger chose day zero as January 1st, 4713 BC. Day one was January 2nd. In this system, October 12, 2011, is Julian Day 2,455,847. The long count calendar began with the date 0.0.0.0.0. Actually, it didn't. Inexplicably, the biggest unit, the 144,000-day millennium, began with 13 rather than 0. The first day in the calendar was thus 13.0.0.0.0. When I remarked on the peculiarity of this exception to a mathematician, he pointed out societies whose timekeeping systems are so irregular that children have to learn rhymes to remember the number of days in the months, 30 days, half September, are in no position to scoff at the calendrical eccentricities of other cultures. At least all the months in the Mesoamerican calendar had the same number of days, he said. Mathematically, what is most striking about this date, 0.0.0.0.0, is that the zeros are true zeros. Zero has two functions. It is a number manipulated like other numbers, which means that it is differentiated from nothing. And it is a placeholder in a positional notation system, such as our base 10 system, in which a number like 1 can signify a single unit if it is in the digits column, or 10 units if it is in the adjacent column. That zero is not the same as nothing is a concept that baffled Europeans as late as the Renaissance. How can you calculate with nothing, they asked, fearing that Hindu-Arabic numerals, the 0 through 9 used today, would promote confusion and fraud. Some European authorities banned them until the 14th century. A classic demonstration of zero status as a number, according to science historian Dick Teresi, is grade point average. In a four-point system, an A equals 4, B equals 3, and so on, down to E, which equals 0. If a student takes four courses and gets A's in two but fails the other two, he receives a GPA of 2.0, or a C average. The two zeros drag down the two A's. If zero were nothing, the student could claim that the grades for the courses he failed did not exist and demand a 4.0 average. His dean would laugh at such logic. Without a positional notation system, arithmetic is tedious and hard, as school children learn when teachers force them to multiply or subtract with Roman numerals. In Roman numerals, capital CLIV is 154, whereas capital XLII is 42. Maddeningly, both numbers have capital L, 50, as the second symbol, but the two capital L's aren't equivalent, because the second is modified by the preceding capital X, which subtracts 10 from it to make 40. Even though both capital CLIV and capital XLII are four-digit numbers, the left-hand symbol in the first number, capital C, cannot be directly compared with the left-hand symbol in the second, capital X. Positional notation symbols take the aggravation out of arithmetic. Sterling Stila, in Tres Zapotes, bore a long count date of 7.16.6.16.18. The implication is that by 32 BC, the Olmec already had all three calendars and zero to boot. One can't be sure, because the date does not include a zero or a reference to the other calendars. But it is hard to imagine how one could have a long count without them. Tentatively, therefore, archaeologists assign the invention of zero to sometime before 32 BC, centuries ahead of its invention in India. How long before 32 BC? The carved cadaver in San Jose Magote may give a hint. In Mesoamerican cultures, the date of one's birth was such an important augury of the future that people often acquired that day as their name. It was as if coming into the world on New Year's Day were such a sign of good fortune that children born on that day would be named January 1st. This seems to have been the case for the man whose death was celebrated in the San Jose Magote Temple. Between his feet are two glyphs, one resembling a stovepipe hat with a U painted across the front, the other looking vaguely like a smiling pet monster from a Japanese cartoon. According to Marcus, the Michigan anthropologist, the glyphs correspond to one earthquake, the Zapotec name for the 17th day of the 260-day sacred calendar. Because the carving depicts a man instead of an event, the date is generally thought to be the dead man's name. If so, one earthquake is the first named person in the history of the Americas. Even if the date is not a name, the two glyphs indicate that by 750 BC, when the slab was carved, the Zapotec were not only on the way to some form of writing, but had also assembled some of the astronomical and mathematical knowledge necessary for a calendar. To judge by the archaeological record, this development took place in an astonishingly compressed period. What took the Sumerians 6,000 years apparently occurred in Mesoamerica in fewer than 1,000. Indeed, Mesoamerican societies during that time created more than a dozen systems of writing, some of which are known only from a single brief text. The exact chronology of their evolution remains unknown, but could be resolved by the next object that a farmer discovers in a field. The earliest known Olmec writing, for example, is on a potsherd from Chiapas that dates from about 300 BC. For a long time, nobody could read it. In 1986, a work crew building a dock on the Acula River in Veracruz pulled out a 7-foot stela covered with Olmec symbols. Thought to have been written in 159 AD, the 21 columns of glyphs were the first Olmec text long enough to permit linguists to decipher the language. Two linguists did just that in 1993. The Stela recounted the rise of a warrior king named Harvest Mountain Lord, who celebrated his ascension to the throne by decapitating his main rival during the coronation. This information in hand, the linguists went back to the writing on the potsherd. Disappointingly, it turned out to be some banal utterances about dying and cutting cloth. From one earthquake to eight deer. The development of writing in Zapotec society went hand in hand with growing urbanization. In about 500 BC, San Jose Mogote seems to have transplanted itself to Monte Alban in the middle of the buffer zone. About half an hour by bus from Oaxaca City, Monte Alban is today a decorous sprawl of walls and pyramids enveloped by a lush lawn. This last is an import from Europe. Lawn grass did not exist in the Americas prior to Columbus. Arriving tourists are hailed by guides with backpacks full of phony ancient figurines and ethnically incorrect souvenirs of Mexica drawings. Their ministrations do not diminish the lonely dignity of the ruins. Monte Alban is atop a steep, 1,500-foot hill that overlooks the valley of Oaxaca. The Zapotec reconfigured the entire hill to build the city, slicing out terraces and platforms. By leveling the entire summit, they created a 55-acre terrace half the size of the Vatican. At its zenith, Monte Alban housed 17,000 people and was by a considerable margin the biggest and most powerful population center in Mesoamerica. The rationale for its construction is the subject of yet another lengthy archaeological dispute. One side proposes that Monte Alban, formed because maize agriculture allowed the Oaxaca Valley's population to grow so much that the rural villages naturally clustered into something resembling cities. For most of its history, Monte Alban was thus a huge village, not a true city, and certainly not a hierarchical state. Others argue that warfare had grown so devastating, as shown by the destruction of San Jose Mogote, that the main valley chiefdoms formed a defensive confederation headquartered at Monte Alban. Yet a third theory is that the Zapotec of Monte Alban, not the Olmec of La Venta, consolidated to form North America's first imperialist power, an aggressive state that subjugated dozens of other villages. Among the strongest evidence for the last view are the nearly 300 carved stone slabs at Monte Alban that depict slain, mutilated enemies. The rulers, Marcus believes, of communities conquered by Monte Alban. Some of the stones are labeled with enemy names, as with the unfortunate one earthquake. These may commemorate victories in Monte Alban's grinding battle for supremacy with its local rival. San Martin, Tilquehete, in the southern arm of the Central Valley. When San Jose Mogote founded Monte Alban, Tilquehete responded by gathering people from its surrounding villages, doubling in size, and erecting its own ceremonial buildings. War was the inevitable result. Monte Alban sacked Tilquehete in about 375 BC. Undiscouraged, Tilquehete rebuilt itself on a better defensive position and acquired larger armies. When it again became a threat, Monte Alban attacked for the second time in 120 BC. This time, its forces finished the job. They burned the king's palace to the ground and emptied the rest of Tilquehete, leaving Monte Alban firmly in control of the entire valley. With nothing to impede it, Monte Alban swept out and established a domain of almost 10,000 square miles. For centuries, it stood on equal ground with its neighbors, the rising Maya states to the east, and Teotihuacan to the north. It enjoyed relatively peaceful relations with both, but had continual trouble with the Nusawe. Spaniards call them the Mixtec, a constellation of petty principalities immediately to the west. By contrast with Monte Alban, these were minuscule entities, Most were clusters of rustic villages covering 10 to 20 square miles. Yet they were amazingly troublesome. Monte Alban repeatedly overran the Nassawi statelets, but never managed to eliminate them. These tiny, fractious domains endured more than 1,000 years. Meanwhile, the much stronger and more centralized Zapotec Empire collapsed completely in about 800 AD. Nassawi writing survives in 8 codices, the deerskin or bark books, whose painted pages could be folded like screens or hung on the wall like a mural. The Spaniards destroyed all the rest. More purely pictorial than Zapotec or Maya script, the texts were arranged almost randomly on the page. Red lines directed the reader's eye from image to image. The symbols included drawings of events, portraits labeled by name, the King Four Wind, for example, being shown by symbolic wind and four little bubbles in a line, and even punning rebuses. Enough writing has survived to give, when coupled with archaeological studies, a vivid picture of Nassawi life. Like medieval Italian city-states, Nassawi principalities were rigidly stratified, with the king and a small group of kinspeople and noble advisors gobbling up much of the wealth and land. They constantly shifted configuration, some expanding by swarming over their neighbors, others imploding when their constituent villages seceded and joined other polities. More commonly, two states joined when their rulers married. Alliance through royal marriage was as common in 11th century Mixteca as it was in 17th century Europe. In both, royal family trees formed an intricate network across national boundaries. But in Mixteca, the queen's land stayed in her line. The king's heir wasn't necessarily the queen's heir. Another difference? Primogeniture was not expected. If the queen did not think her eldest son was fit for the crown, she could pass it to another child, or even to a nephew or cousin. No fewer than 4 of the codices treat the story of 8 deer jaguar claw, a wily priest, general, politician, with a tragic love for the wife of his greatest enemy. Born in 1063 AD, 8 deer was a shirt-tailed cousin to the ruling family of Tilatongo, which had been engaged for decades in a dynastic struggle with the kingdom of Red and White Bundle. The name, a modern invention, comes from its name glyph, which pictures the cloth wrapping used by the Nassawi to wrap holy objects. Its exact location is still not nailed down. Like his father, a high cleric, Eight Deer was trained for the priesthood, but political events and his own overweening ambition stopped him from following that path. After an unprovoked attack on Red and White Bundle by Tilatongo raised hostilities to a fever, the warring parties agreed to meet in a sacred mountain cave with the priestess of the dead, a powerful oracle who had stripped away the flesh from her jaw, giving her a terrifying, skull-like appearance. Tilatongo's representative was Eight Deer, who attended the meeting in place of his recently deceased father. To his dismay, the priestess sided with Tilatongo's enemies and ordered Eight Deer, Tilatongo's champion, to exile himself 100 miles away in a jerkwater town on the Pacific called Tututepec. Tucked away in Tututepec, Eight Deer assembled a private army, staffed it with many relatives, and in a series of swift campaigns seized dozens of neighboring villages and city-states. In addition to assembling the greatest empire ever seen in the region, the conquest managed to kill off most of the siblings and cousins above him in the line of royal succession. After 6 years of war, he returned home to Tilatongo. During this visit, according to John M.D. Pohl, the archaeologist whose interpretations I am mostly following here, Eight Deer accidentally encountered Six Monkey, the young wife of the much older king of Red and White Bundle. Despite the long enmity between the two kingdoms, Eight Deer and Six Monkey secretly became lovers. In 1096, Tilatongo's sovereign died in mysterious circumstances. The priestess of the dead selected Eight Deer's beloved elder half-brother to be the regent. That is, the half-brother became the last person between Eight Deer and the throne of Tilatongo. 3 years later, unknown assailants stab the half-brother to death in a sweat bath. The inconsolable Eight-Deer took the throne of Tila Tongo and declared war on Red and White Bundle, which he claimed had orchestrated the murder. Red and White Bundle's royal palace was built on a cliff over a bend in the river. Guarded by sheer walls on three sides, its soldiers had only to watch the fourth side, across which was an earthen berm. Leading an army of 1,000, Eight-Deer threw up ladders, swarmed over the berm with his men, and entered the palace. As befit a conqueror, Eight-Deer was wearing elaborate cotton armor, a ceremonial beard wig, and a cowl made from the head of a jaguar. Gold and jade necklaces dangled across his naked chest. In the palace, he found Six Monkey and her husband, the king of Red and White Bundle. Both were mortally wounded. In Pole's account, Eight-Deer held Six Monkey as she died. Captured with the royal couple were their two sons, the elder of whom, Forwind, was heir to the throne. Seizing him by the hair, Eight-Deer forced the teenager to grovel before him. But he also made what seems to have been a sentimental decision. He spared the life of his lover's son. The folly of this action became apparent when Forwind and his brother escaped from confinement. Seeking revenge, Forwind approached the Zapotec Empire for help. With Zapotec backing, he linked rebels in Red and White Bundle and a host of other cities defeated by Eight-Deer. They besieged Tila Tongo in 1115. The battle lasted 6 months and ended in total defeat for Tila Tongo. In a mirror image of the past, the captured Eight-Deer was forced to bow to Forwind. He was 55 years old and had 6 official kingships and dozens of petty states under his control. Victorious and vengeful, Forwind personally disemboweled him. Then he married Eight-Deer's daughter. In Forwind's first exercise of statecraft, he abandoned the Zapotec allies who had helped him achieve the throne, aligned Tila Tongo with the Toltec Empire to the north, and attacked the Zapotec. Ultimately, the Nasawi under his lead took over much of Oaxaca, forcing the Zapotec states to pay tribute. The empire he established, far bigger than Eight-Deer's, lasted until the 15th century, when the Mexica invaded, and then came Cortez. Wheeled Interlude. As Matthew Sterling and his team were dodging ticks and unearthing stele in Tres Zapotes, they found a cache of 15 upside-down pottery bowls tucked into the ground 6 feet below the surface. The bowls protectively covered 35 toy-sized decorated figurines and 12 small printed clay discs. Among the figurines were 2 dogs and a jaguar, each of which had thin tubes joining its 2 front feet and its 2 back feet. The discs lay beside them. Similar finds have been made further north, near Mexico City. In the 1980s, I saw the Tres Zapotes animals, or ones like them, at a museum in the Yucatan Peninsula. I was there with an Italian engineer whom I had met by chance a few hours before. Well before me, the engineer figured out the significance of the tubes between the figurine's feet. "Those are for axles," he said. "And those," pointing to the discs, "must be the wheels." Looking at the little figures, it seemed obvious that they had been equipped with wheels in precisely the form he suggested. The engineer scrunched up his face with incredulity. Tres Zapotes dated back to at least 1000 BC. So the Olmec and their successors must have had the wheel for more than 2000 years. "Why didn't they use it for anything other than little toys?" he asked in Italian. "How could they not have understood that you could make bigger wheels and put them on carts?"
"Hanno fatto proprio una stupidaggine, quei tipi."
The word stupidaggine, an absurdity, similar enough in Italian and Spanish, rang out in the room, drawing stares. The engineer seemed not to care. He looked positively offended at the Olmec failure to see the world in the same way as a contemporary European engineer. I'm giving my acquaintance a hard time, but his bafflement was easy for me to understand. In Mesopotamia, the wheel dates back to at least the time of Sumer. It was a basic part of life throughout Eurasia. Chariot wheels, water wheels, potter's wheels, millstone wheels. One can't imagine Europe or China without them. The only thing more mysterious than failing to invent the wheel would be inventing the wheel and then failing to use it. But that is exactly what the Indians did. Presumably, countless thousands of people rolled the toy-like figurines back and forth. How could none of them have thought of making their wheels bigger and more useful? Some reasons are apparent. Because of the Pleistocene extinctions, the Americas lacked animals suitable for domestication into beasts of burden. Without animals to haul carts, individuals on rough terrain can use skids almost as effectively. Even with animals, though, the Olmec would not have had much use for wheeled vehicles. Their country is so wet and boggy that Sterling's horses sank to their chests in mud. Boats were a primary means of transportation until recently. In addition, one might note that Mesoamerican societies were not alone in their wheel blindness. Although Mesopotamia had the wheel in about 4000 BC, nearby Egypt did not use the wheel until 2000 years later, despite being in close contact. Still, none of this explains why no Mesoamerican society ever used wheels to make ceramics and grind maize. After all, every society in Eurasia eventually employed pottery wheels and mill wheels. A better answer might be one implicit in Robert Temple's book, The Genius of China, A History of Chinese Science and Technology, published in 1998. According to Temple, the Chinese invented the moldboard plow by the 3rd century BC. Made of cast iron, the plowshare was shaped like a V, with the blade carving into the ground and the two arms arcing away like gull wings. Because the arms were curved, they turned the earth away from the blade, which both reduced friction and more effectively plowed the soil. The moldboard is the curved plowshare. The name comes from mold, the old German word for soil. The design of the moldboard plow is so obvious that it seems incredible that Europeans never thought of it. Until the Chinese-style plow was imported in the 17th century, farmers in France, Germany, Italy, the Netherlands, and other states labored to shove what amounted to a narrow slab of metal through the earth. The increased friction meant that huge multiple teams of oxen were required, whereas Chinese plows could make do with a single ox, Temple explained. The European failure to think up the moldboard, according to science historian Teresi, was as if Henry Ford designed the car without an accelerator, and you had to put the car in neutral, brake, and go under the hood to change speed. And then we did this for 2,000 years. European agricultural production exploded after the arrival of the moldboard plow. The prosperity this engendered was one of the cushions on which the Enlightenment floated. So inefficient, so wasteful of effort, and so utterly exhausting was the old plow, Temple wrote, that this deficiency of plowing may rank as mankind's single greatest waste of time and energy. Millions of Europeans spent centuries behind the plow, staring at the blade as it ineffectively mired itself in the earth. How could none of them have thought of changing the design to make the plow more useful? The complexity of a society's technology has little to do with its level of social complexity. Something that we, in our era of rapidly changing, seemingly overwhelming technology, have trouble grasping. Every society, big or little, misses out on obvious technologies. The lacunae have enormous impact on people's lives. Imagine Europe with efficient plows, or the Maya with iron tools. But not much effect on the scale of a civilization's endeavors, as shown by both European and Maya history. The corollary is that widespread and open trade in ideas is the best way to make up for the lacunae. Alas, Mesoamerica was limited in this respect. Like Europe, it was an extraordinarily diverse place with a shared cultural foundation. But where Europe had the profoundly different civilizations of China and Islam to steal from, Mesoamerica was alone in the world. Or seemed to be, anyway. A slice of Peru. About 100 miles north of the Peru-Chile border, the coastal highway passes by an uninhabited beach ringed by a tall chain-link fence. The fence has an entrance with a gigantic, stylized statue of a woman with huge earrings. By the statue hangs a faded banner, Bolivia Mar. When Bolivia declared its independence, it had a territorial pseudopod that extended southwest from its Andean heartland through the Atacama Desert to the sea. The land was useless for agriculture, but had 4 plausible seaports and huge underground deposits of prehistoric guano, which Chilean companies mined and shipped to Europe for fertilizer. Bolivia, then as now impoverished, didn't have the capital for this industry. In 1878, Hilarion Daza, the illegitimate son of an Italian acrobat, seized power in Bolivia. Immediately, he raised taxes on the Chilean-owned guano mines, which the previous Bolivian government had promised not to do. Outraged, Chile rolled its army into the area. In vain did Bolivia counterattack with its ally, Peru. Chile simply repelled their incompetently led forces and took over the entire territory, as well as a chunk of southern Peru. Ejected in an outburst of popular anger, Daza fled to Europe, taking most of Bolivia's treasury with him. Chile finally returned most of Peru's territory in 1929, but never gave back any land to Bolivia, an outcome that nation has never accepted. To this day, Bolivia's parliament has a representative from the lost maritime province. The Miss Bolivia contest always includes a contestant ostensibly from the coast. Maps are sold in which the conquered land is still part of Bolivia. In a gesture to its long-time, long-suffering ally, Peru symbolically gave 2 miles of its shoreline to Bolivia in 1992. Bolivia Mar, Bolivia by the Sea, is a little island of Bolivia entirely surrounded by Peru. It has no facilities of any kind, so far as I could tell when I passed by. Private enterprise was supposed to build an industrial duty-free port in Bolivia Mar. Thus far, the free market has not accepted the challenge. Every now and then, parties of Bolivians drive down to Bolivia Mar to swim, a political gesture. The main highway from Bolivia Mar to Bolivia itself follows the Osmore Valley, cutting a perfect sectional slice through Peru on the way. For the first 15 miles, the road climbs through a desert landscape almost devoid of settlement and prone to fog. Then the road hits a plateau and the fog dissipates. The landscape that comes into view is so dry that in most years, the Osmore River simply disappears into the desert. Around the small city of Moquegua, the river hoves back into view, and the highway abruptly pitches into the Cordillera Negra. The windshield fills with enough canyons, bluffs, mesas, and cliffs for a dozen Roadrunner cartoons. Standing higher than its neighbors, at an altitude of about 8,000 feet, is a wide pillar of rock with a rounded, convoluted top that vaguely resembles the rounded, convoluted top of a human brain. The pillar is called Cerro Baúl. For about 200 years, it was the sole meeting ground of 2 of the America's largest societies. Societies similar in scale to, say, the Maya realm, but much less well-known. The 2 states, Huari and Tiwanaku, were probably the greatest of the Inca's forerunners, and certainly the predecessors from whom they took the most. In their separate ways, both were children of Norte Chico. They worshipped figures in staff god poses, lived in networks of vertical exchange, and had public architecture with designs based on templates from the coast. But in other ways, they were as different from each other as Sicily and Scandinavia. Of the 2, Huari was the more conventional, centralized state. Based east of Lima in the Andes Heights, it first became prominent in the 6th century AD. A bad time to be launching a nation on the Pacific side of South America. At about that time, Andean societies were assailed by the first of several decades-long droughts, paradoxically interrupted by El Niño-induced floods. Some polities may have disintegrated beneath the climactic assault, but Wari thrived. The principal reason for its success was its innovative techniques of terracing and irrigation, the latter being used to implement the former. Surprisingly, Peru has more arable land above 9,000 feet than below. By diverting snowmelt from the ever-present Andes ice caps to high farm terraces, Wari was able literally to rise above the drought and flooding of lower elevations. The staple crop of the highlands was the potato, which, unlike maize, regularly grows at altitudes of 14,000 feet. The tubers, cultivated in hundreds of varieties, can be left in the ground for as long as a year, as long as the soil stays above 27 degrees Fahrenheit, to be dug up and cooked when needed. Even frozen potatoes could be used. After letting freezing night temperatures break down the tuber cell walls, Andean farmers stomped out the water content to make dried chunya, a nigh indestructible foodstuff that could be stored for years. The potato's cold tolerance spurred its embrace by European peasants. Not only did potatoes grow in places where other crops could not, the plant was an ally in smallholders' ceaseless struggle against the economic and political elite. A farmer's barnful of wheat, rye, or barley was a fat target for greedy landlords and marauding armies. Buried in the soil, a crop of potatoes could not be easily seized. Maize, though, was what people wanted, the grain of choice for the elite. It was what you made chicha from. Its prestige was another reason for Wari's success. Because terraces soak up more sunlight than steep slopes, maize can be grown at higher than usual altitudes on them. Irrigation, similarly, increases the area available for maize farming. In a process that Michael Mosley has likened to patenting and marketing a major invention, the Wari passed on their reclamation techniques to their neighbors, bringing a 1,000-mile-long swath of the Peruvian Andes under their cultural sway. A sign of their influence was the spread of the Wari religion, in which the figure archaeologists call staff god was dominant. Though the Wari transformed the staff, as if to remind others of their agricultural beneficence, into a stalk of maize. By the end of the first millennium AD, Wari techniques had reclaimed more than 1 million acres of cropland for mountainsides that almost anywhere else would have been regarded as impossibly dry, steep, and cold. Today, 3/4 of the terraces are abandoned, and the alpine landscape has not regained the productivity it had 1,000 years ago. But until the Spanish conquest, Andean valleys were so thoroughly punctuated by Wari-inspired terraces that to the Jesuit Bernabe Cobo, they looked as if they were covered with flights of stairs. Wari's capital city, also named Wari, occupied an alpine plateau near the modern city of Ayacucho. Construction began in the first few centuries AD. The city ultimately spread across 2 square miles, an array of 2- and 3-story buildings in compounds behind massive walls. Both peasant homes and great palaces were built in similar styles, according to William H. Isbell, an anthropologist at the State University of New York at Binghamton, and Alexei Vranich, an archaeologist at the University of Pennsylvania Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology. Everything was enclosed behind high, white walls in what the two researchers described in 2004 as a hive of repetitive modular cells organized in high-walled geometric blocks. There were no standout public buildings, no great public spaces, no spectacular vistas, only a thicket of walls and narrow streets strewn with garbage. Archaeologists have turned up so few clean floors and surfaces, Isbell and Vranich wrote, that it is apparent that Wari people experience domestic refuse as benign and unthreatening. Apparently, the walls ringing and crisscrossing the city were intended for privacy, not protection. Wari was not located in an easily defended spot. Along the spine of the Andes, the empire set up a string of 12 administrative centers that were like smaller versions of the capital. These were not built with defense in mind, either. Indeed, there is little record of Wari warfare. Its supremacy was commercial and intellectual. It was based less on infantry troops than on innovative technology. All of which may explain some of its behavior in Cerro Baul. Wari emissaries arrived in Moquegua around 600 AD. According to Patrick Ryan Williams and Donna V. Nash, field museum archaeologists who have been working there since the early 1990s. A simpler culture had already staked out the best farmland in the area. The Wari neither aggressively threw them out, nor withdrew in dismay. Guided, one imagines, by instructions from headquarters, they quickly set up living quarters on Cerro Baul itself. The Big Mesa is to this day regarded as an Apu, an ancient spirit transfigured into rock. Thus, putting a city directly on top of it was an arresting statement. Here we are. On a practical level, living on a 500-yard-long mesa was a daunting task. To supply water, the Wari carved a 15-mile canal through the mountains from the peaks to the bottom of Cerro Baul, an engineering feat that would be a challenge today. And even that got water only to the bottom of the hill, Williams told me. After that, it was bucket brigades. As I huffed and puffed on the wickedly steep, 30-minute hike to the summit, he invited me to imagine a continuous line of servants exchanging ceramic jugs, slopping, brimful ones going up, light empty ones going down, along the path, working day in and day out to provide water for the priests and princes above. Small, rudely fashioned models of farmhouses and farmyards covered the top of the butte. Most of the models simply outlined walls, fences, and doors with loose stones. But some were elaborate constructions complete with plastic model cars, toy animals, and thatch roofs. People were climbing Cerro Baul, building their maquettes, and praying that the heavens would give them the real-life equivalents. The miniature farms extended for hundreds of yards in all directions. Here and there, makeshift crosses and pictures of saints added a veneer of Catholicism to indigenous Andean belief. Some of the ruined Wari walls were covered with ruined model walls. This is getting out of hand, William said. I don't want to knock down somebody's dream house to get to an archaeological site. In about 750 AD, about a century after Wari came to Cerro Baul, Tiwanaku groups infiltrated the region around it. In most places on Earth, this encounter would have been fraught with tension. And perhaps if Tiwanaku had been more like Wari, there would have been immediate war. But Tiwanaku was so different in so many ways that ordinary expectations rarely apply to it. The celebrated anthropologist Clifford Geertz has half-jokingly suggested that all states can be parceled into four types. Pluralist, in which the state is seen by its people as having moral legitimacy. Populist, in which government is viewed as an expression of the people's will. Great Beast, in which the ruler's power depends on using force to keep the populace cowed. And Great Fraud, in which the elite uses smoke and mirrors to convince the people of its inherent authority. Every state is a mix of all of these elements, but in Tiwanaku, the proportion of great fraud may have been especially high. Nonetheless, Tiwanaku endured for many centuries. Tiwanaku's capital, Tiwanaku City, was at the southwest end of Lake Titicaca. Situated at 12,600 feet, it was the highest city in the ancient world. Today, visitors from lower altitudes are constantly warned that the area is very cold. Bring warm clothing, Williams advised me in Cerro Baul. You're going to freeze. The warnings puzzled me, because Lake Titicaca, which is big enough to stay at a near-constant 51 degrees Fahrenheit, moderates the local climate. This is one reason why agriculture is possible at such height. On winter nights, the average temperature is a degree below freezing. Cold, but not any colder than New England. And considerably warmer than one would expect at 12,600 feet. Only when I traveled there did I realize that this was the temperature indoors. The modern town of Tiwanaku is a poor place, and few of its buildings have any heating. One night there, I attended a performance at a family circus that was touring the Andes. It was so cold inside the tent that for the first few minutes, the audience was shrouded in a cloud of its own breath. My host that night was an American archaeologist. When I woke the next morning in her spare bedroom, my host, in parka, hat, and gloves, was melting water on her stove. The cold does not detract from the area's beauty. Tiwanaku sits in the middle of a plain ringed by ice-capped mountains. From the ruins' taller buildings, the Great Lake, almost 10 miles to the northwest, is just visible. The wide expanse of water seems to merge into the sky without a welt. The first important settlement around Titicaca was likely Chiripa, on a little peninsula on the lake's southwest coast. Its ceremonial center, which may date to 900 BC, was built around a Norte Chico-style sunken plaza. Chiripa was one of half a dozen small, competitive centers that emerged around the lake in that time. Most depended on raised field agriculture, in which farmers grow crops on flat, artificially constructed surfaces created for the same reason that home gardeners grow vegetables on raised beds. Similar but even larger expanses of raised fields are found in the Beni, the Mexican Basin, and many other places. By the time of Christ's birth, two of these early polities had become dominant. Pucara, on the northern Peruvian edge of the lake, and Tiwanaku on the opposite Bolivian side. In the 3rd century AD, Pucara rather abruptly disintegrated politically. People still lived there, but the towns dispersed into the countryside. Pottery making, stela carving, and monument building ceased. No one is certain why. Although Tiwanaku has been occupied since at least 800 BC, it did not become an important center until about 300 BC, and did not expand out from southern Titicaca until about 200 years after Pucara's decline. But when it did reach out to its south and west, Tiwanaku transformed itself to become what Alan Colada, an archaeologist at the University of Chicago, has called a predatory state. It was not the centrally administered military power that term conjures. Instead, it was an archipelago of cities that acknowledged Tiwanaku's religious preeminence. State religion and imperial ideology, Colada argued, performed much the same work as military conquest, but at significantly lower cost. Awed by its magnificence, fearful of the supernatural powers controlled by its priesthood, local rulers subordinated themselves. Central to this strategy of intimidation was Tiwanaku City. A past wonder of the world, it is badly damaged today. In the last 2 centuries, people have literally carted away many of its buildings, using the stones for churches, homes, bridges, public buildings, and even landfill. At one point, the Bolivian government drove a railroad through the site. Recently, it laid a road through another part. Hands more enthusiastic than knowledgeable reconstructed many of the remaining buildings. Still, enough remains to get a sense of the ancient city. Dominating its skyline was a 7-tiered pyramid, Acapana, laid out in a pattern perhaps inspired by the Andean cross. Ubiquitous in Highlands art, the Andean cross is a stepped shape that some claim is inspired by the Southern Cross constellation, and others believe represents the 4 quarters of the world. Whatever the case, Acapana's builders planned with a sense of drama. They constructed its base walls with sandstone blocks, the array interrupted every 10 feet by rectangular stone pillars that are easily 10 feet tall. So massive are the pillars that the first European to see Tiwanaku, Pedro Cieza de Leon, later confessed himself unable to understand or fathom what kind of instruments or tools were used to work them. Rising from the center of a large moat, Acapana mimicked the surrounding mountains. A precisely engineered drainage system added to the similarity by channeling water from a cistern-like well at the summit, down and along the sides. A stylized version of rainwater plashing down the Andes. Atop an adjacent, somewhat smaller structure, a large walled enclosure called Colossae, is the so-called gateway of the sun, cut from a single block of stone, now broken in two and